In early 1917, the original Dixieland Jazz Band made the first jazz recording. Over the next 100 years, we've heard transcendent leaps of creativity and staggering virtuosity. We have experienced the music of crushing pain, breathless romance, anger, exhilaration, and humor. This is that story. 100 years of jazz recordings. From WTJU Charlottesville, your host, Russell Perry. Emerging from the J. McShann Orchestra from Kansas City, and relentlessly curious about how to play the new music he heard in his head, Charlie Parker found sympathetic players in New York, especially Dizzy Gillespie. In November of 1945, Bird, as he was universally known, began to record with his own quintets and sextets in a legendary series of recordings for Dial in Hollywood and Savoy in Newark. By the end of 1948, when he began to record for Norman Granz and his Clef, Mercury, and Verve labels, Bird's reputation was forever secure. We are joined in this hour by Robert Jospe, drummer, recording artist, educator, and member of the performance faculty of the McIntyre Department of Music at the University of Virginia. Gary Giddens and Scott DeVoe in their work Jazz have written, "If Parker was bebop's inspiration, the Pied Piper of modern jazz, Gillespie pulled the style into shape like a master craftsman. But if Gillespie was the showman who knew how to sell the new music to skeptics, Parker accrued the saintly aura of a martyr whose every solo demanded preservation and analysis, whose improvisation suggested an emotional density that best captured the agitated temper of the times." They wrote further, "The first true bebop records date from early 1945, a chaotic period just before the end of the war that saw the emergence of small independent record labels, Savoy, Apollo, Dial, with a view towards low-cost way of entering the business, no arrangements, occasional vocals, plenty of blues, but mostly just let the musicians do their thing. The delay in getting bop recorded was largely caused by two recording bands that lasted almost 3 years, instituted by the despotic boss of the musicians' union, James Petrillo. As a result, most people had never heard of bop and certainly didn't have a chance to follow its development during these crucial years. But the real shock came with Parker's first session under his own name, recorded late in 1945 and released the following year. In the first Savoy session, Miles Davis, a new member at 19 of Parker's band, played trumpet on most of the session, but was not up to the blazing 8-bar exchanges at the beginning and end of Coco. So Gillespie took up the trumpet for those elaborate passages. Somehow out of this chaos came a bellwether jazz masterpiece, bop's equivalent of Louis Armstrong's West End Blues. Parker's two white-hot choruses, only upon repeated listening does it become evident that, for all his speed and seeming volatility, Parker plays melodies and riffs, preceded by the boldly disorienting introduction and followed by a lightning-fast Max Roach drum solo, was a music so startlingly different that it demanded a new name, bebop. At once an insider's term and a trivialization of the music, it stuck to it like crazy glue. From November 26 of 1945, first a false start, and then the master take of Coco by Charlie Parker's Reboppers, Dizzy Gillespie on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto sax, Argon Thornton on piano, Curly Russell on bass, and Max Roach on drums. We'll be right back. Coco by Charlie Parker's Reboppers. After the Coco session, Gillespie and Bird took the new music to L.A. When Bird missed the flight home, his trip stretched out more than a year, including a stay at Camarillo State Penitentiary. Before that, he signed on with the new Dial label for a $100 advance. Ted Gioia wrote, "The Dial work, judged as a whole, contains much of Parker's finest music, but the initial March 28, 1946 date proved especially memorable. Only four compositions were recorded, but each ranks as a bop masterpiece. Moose the Mooch, named by Parker after his L.A. narcotic supplier, features a clever stop-and-start melody over I Got Rhythm Changes and stellar alto solos on all the takes. On Yardbird Suite and Ornithology, Parker provides whirlwind 32-bar solos, but the highlight of the session was Night at Tunisia. This Gillespie composition sets up the first soloist with an interlude leading into a 4-bar break. Parker uses this break to execute a mesmerizing double-time jazz cadenza. Few jazz reed players could approach the sheer speed of this passage, but even more impressive is the rhythmic phrasing, in which coy accents, oddly placed in crevices between the beats, impart a bobbing, weaving quality to the horn line. The complete master takes from the March 28, 1946 recordings by the Charlie Parker Septet, Moose the Mooch, Yardbird Suite, Ornithology, and A Night in Tunisia. Moose the Mooch, Yardbird Suite, Ornithology, and A Night in Tunisia by the Charlie Parker Septet. Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker alto, Lucky Thompson tenor, Dodo Marmarosa piano, Vic McMillan bass, Roy Porter drums. Quoting again from Giddens and DeVoe, Embraceable You, recorded in 1947, is the best known of his several interpretations of the chord changes to George Gershwin's celebrated ballad. On none of them, however, does he play the actual tune. In fact, he usually gave his recorded interpretations new titles, like Meandering and Quasimodo. Yet here he uses the Gershwin title, sacrificing his potential royalties. Parker plays with a softness and earnestness that beautifully captures the song's romantic essence, yet he barely touches down on Gershwin's melody, floating instead on rapid and constantly shifting phrases, playing a stream of 32nd notes at paradoxically slow tempo. From October of 1947, the Charlie Parker Quintet, playing Embraceable You, and another version, this time from December of 47, and entitled Quasimodo, by the original Charlie Parker Quintet with J.J. Johnson. Thank you. Embraceable You and Quasimodo, Charlie Parker's quintet. We'll return to Jazz at 100 in a moment and the legendary Dial and Savoy recordings of Charlie Yardbird Parker. Welcome back to Jazz at 100 and the mid-1940s masterpieces of Charlie Parker. In his History of Jazz, Ted Gioia wrote, Miles Davis, the future leader of the cool movement, would seem an unlikely choice to share the front line with the firebrand altoist. Some have suggested this was only part of a long-standing pattern of Parker's. Time and again, his musical instincts led him to hire trumpeters who would counterbalance rather than mimic his high-powered improvisations. With Davis, with Chet Baker, with Kenny Dorham, with Red Rodney, Parker invariably reached for more low-key and reflective melodic voices, a tonic to offset his acidic alto lines. Let's turn to Donna Lee, of which Gioia wrote, Hear Davis's attempts to follow Parker on Donna Lee. Davis is anything but calm and collected. His phrasing is nervous, his articulation suspect, yet Parker must have seen, if not the future of the birth of the cool, at least some diamond in the rough in this teenage acolyte, hints of greatness that the surviving recordings from that period do not show. After all, Bird, who could have his pick more or less of any trumpeter, opted for unknown and unheralded Miles Dewey Davis. We'll follow Donnelly with Chasin' the Bird, both by Charlie Parker's All-Stars, from May 8th of 1947. Thank you. Donna Lee and Chasin' the Bird, Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, along with Bud Powell on piano, Tommy Potter on bass, and Max Roach on drums. And now let's turn the spotlight on Max Roach. Martin Williams from the Notes for the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz has written, on Klaktovi Sedstein, note the superb, varied, interplaying percussion of Max Roach, a definitive statement of bebop or modern drumming, and the perfect drum counterpart to Parker's own innovations. We asked drummer Robert Jospe to introduce Max Roach's participation in the Charlie Parker Quintet.
So we're going to hear a very active drum involvement in this music, much different than what you hear with big bands. Of course, big band drumming does accent the arrangements and the melodies, but there are bigger motions with the music. When we get into the intricacy of bebop and the technique from Charlie Parker and these heads that are much more involved rhythmically, the drums go along with that. And we start to see with Max Roach the beginning of a very interactive role for the drummer in the music, much more than in big band. In big band, you play the arrangement, keep time for the soloist, not that much interactive stuff between the soloist and the drummer. In the small groups in the bebop, you're going to hear Max playing all around this music. He's improvising along with the soloist. He's commenting on the soloist as he's playing. He's improvising along with them, and he's using a lot of interactive accents with the bass drum and the snare drum along with the ride cymbal. The ride cymbal's keeping time, but it's not just going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. It's moving that beat around. Ding 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 ding. That kind of stuff. And then the bass drum is hitting accents along with the snare, different kinds of combinations of accents and polyrhythms between the bass drum and the snare drum and the ride cymbal, of course. The whole drum set is starting to pick up and become more involved.
Robert Jospe. Let's listen to Klaktovi Sedstein from the Charlie Parker Quintet from November of 1947, followed by Scrapple from the Apple, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, Duke Jordan on piano, Tommy Potter on bass, and featuring Max Roach on drums.
Thank you.
Clacked Ovi Sedstein and Scrapple from the Apple by Charlie Parker Quintet. And now a final word on Max Roach from Robert Jaspe.
Yes, Max Roach, along with opening up the role of the drummer in the rhythm section, Max pioneered the modern bebop drum solo. And Max, I would say, would be considered in a lot of ways to be the first drummer to embrace the drum set as a complete instrument on its own, an instrument that could hold the attention of an audience without any other accompaniment. He would do solo concerts. He would work with other percussionists as well, but he could just take a drum set and play a concerto, play a whole symphony on the drum set, so to speak. And he had so much technique, so many ideas, and showed the world how a drum set could become just a complete instrument on its own. And there are many drummers that took that concept and developed it, but Max pioneered it.
Robert Jaspe. We'll return to Jazz at 100 in a moment and the legendary Dial and Savoy recordings of Charlie Parker. Welcome back to Jazz at 100 and the mid-1940s masterpieces of Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker found his trombone match in a young player named J.J. Johnson. Martin Williams from the Notes of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz has written of the upcoming tune, "This recording, originally released under the title Crazyology, is actually trumpeter Benny Harris's piece, Little Benny. It features trombonist J.J. Johnson as guest with Parker's quintet. It was Johnson who first developed a trombone style for modern jazz, actually an adroit, almost abstract, virtuoso style that placed the horn on the same level as the trumpet and the saxophone. Crazyology from the original Charlie Parker quintet with J.J. Johnson, Miles Davis, J.J. Johnson, Charlie Parker, Duke Jordan, Tommy Potter, and again, Max Roach. Thank you. Craziology, December 1947, from the original Charlie Parker Quintet with J.J. Johnson. We'll continue with Parker's Mood, of which Martin Williams, from the notes of the Smithsonian Collection for Classic Jazz, has written, "Charlie Parker's sober masterpiece in the slow blues is an ingeniously personal condensed synthesis of traditional and original fragments. Also notice pianist John Lewis's fine and almost perfectly complementary episode. He does not break the mood, but his solo is a flow of lyricism in the blues form, with an absolute minimum of blues devices. Those he leaves to Parker." Charlie Parker's All-Stars performing Parker's Mood. Parker's Mood by the Charlie Parker All-Stars, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, John Lewis, Curly Russell, and Max Roach. Some final words. Ben Ratliff from the New York Times Essential Library of Jazz wrote, "I've always preferred Parker's Savoy and Dial material to the recordings he made on Verve because they bear a raw feeling more suited to the music's status as an underground art form. It began as a music played after hours. It was fast, aggressive, aesthetically shocking, and didn't break into national consciousness for years after it began." Trumpeter John Faddis said, Charlie Parker showed Dizzy a way of playing that almost eliminated that swing feel that Dizzy had in the early 40s, but that also incorporated those harmonic ideas that they both created. So I think the way of getting from one note to the next was very much Charlie Parker's influence on Dizzy. But if Charlie Parker was the stylist, Dizzy was sort of the architect that taught the musicians how to build the music. In the next hour of Jazz at 100, we will turn to Dizzy Gillespie, his mid-1940s small groups, and the big bands he returned to whenever he had the opportunity. You have been listening to Jazz at 100, a history of 100 years of jazz recordings, produced by WTJU Charlottesville and made possible in part through a grant from the Virginia Endowment for the Humanities. For full playlists, including all of the players and recording dates, please go to WTJU.net/Jazz100. There you can also stream any of the programs in this series you may have missed. This is your host, Russell Perry. Thanks for joining us.